Blog Talk Radio.
Hold it now.
Good evening. This is We Talk Productions, one of the black radio networks that focus on the solutions of our communities. Present Black Urban America. All you folks that are listed by laptop, you could call in, ask a question, or make a comment. The call-in number is 516-531-9540. Press 1. That's 516-531-9540. 9540 and press 1. The lineup, as usual, Tuesday evenings, we have Black Urban America. I'm your host, Kenny Jones. On Wednesday, we have The Cutting Edge with Michonne Williams. On Thursday, we had the Port of Harlem Magazine Radio with Wayne A. Young. And finishing up the week, we have on Saturday evenings, Provocative Thought by Carter Steves. All shows start at 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, before I bring on my guests, and before we get into the topic of discussion for this evening, I would just like to give 1 minute commentary on what's going on, what continues to go on in this country against black men. I said it since I was a teenager, and I in my twilight years. There is a war against black men. There's a war against black men. It's a war against our emotional status, our physical prowess, any ism you want to put in, there's a war against the black man in America. And it always been that way. From my grandfather's time to my father's time, now to my time. That's in generations. I don't have a son. I have daughters. And it's going to be my grandson's time. It behooves me, these so-called black leaders, that political, economic, social, these so-called black leaders that we have doing the same thing over again with the same results, And why? I know why that we have the injustice and the racism, but this is not a show for that. I know why America hates the black man. I know why, but this is not the show for this. And you want to know something? It's now about to lead into our topic. And we're turning on each other. And they encourage for young black men to turn on each other. And it's affecting our communities, affecting our families, affecting our neighborhood, it's affecting our progress as a people. Don't you know between the ages of 15 and 34, 37% of gun homicides involve young black males between the ages of 15 and 34? And they are only 2% of the population. only 2% of the population, but the 30% of the gun homicides, 63% of the victims are black males. If we to discuss this topic, we have a former victims advocate for Fulton County, Georgia, and also we had he's former marshal for Norfolk State University. Welcome to the show, Mr. Wesley Van. Good evening.
Thank you, Kenny. And you hit that right on the head. You know, when we had talked earlier, I had run across a piece on Facebook. It was a post said a 14-year-old pulls a gun on someone and gets his brains blown out, or blown all over the place. And the question was, who is to blame? And, you know, in the last 48 hours, I've never seen it like this before. I was watching the trial on TV. I'm watching the news. And every day now, there's a new shooting, a school shooting. There's a new cop killing somebody. And it seems like it would stop, but you're right. You know, there's a... My next-door neighbor says this all the time. She says the problem with white men in particular is the fact that they live in fear. They're afraid of young black boys. Not because they're hostile or going to do anything against them, but it's because they know for a fact that they're smart and they're intelligent, and they have a fear of losing their place. You know, I really did want to talk about young folks. You know, I haven't worked in that. One thing, I'll make one quick correction. A marshal at Norfolk State University is a person that runs the commencement exercises. They're in charge of it, and they make sure the graduates and the faculty gets in. I did that. That's exactly right. But I was also director of student activities. And one of the things that I've learned is that college kids, like kindergarten kids, are all the same. You know, they're easily guided, they jump in games, they do the wrong things, but they're young. At least they're blank pages, and we get the opportunity at a university to write something on those pages for them. Now,
right.
At Fulton County, I had the opportunity to work as a victim witness advocate.
Right.
And I was the guy that would, I worked in homicide, so I would call the mother at early in the morning and tell her, we have found and arrested your son's murderer, and the trial is going to go on such and such a date. I hated to meet
that. Hold up, Mr. Van. What did you say to a family member / mom that they lost her son to violence? What type of words come from your heart and your mouth when you say, Mrs. Raheem, your son Hakeem is gone? What's the dialogue? What's the conversation?
It's short. And, you know, one of the things I've learned not to say is that he's in a better place. Because the better place for that mother at that moment is right beside her.
Right.
You know, that's the better place for her at that time because of the way that he died. It wasn't like he had some illness and was sick, or he was 9,000 years old and it was time for him to pass on. This child was murdered. And there is no better place. I've had one parent that the young man was murdered by his friend, and it was a setup. And she said, this boy came and lived with us, and I gave him a place to stay, and he murdered my son. That's hard. That's hard to deal with right there. That was hard for me to deal with some days. You know, I never hated to go to work because in answer to your question, it wasn't the fact of having the right words to say, but you have to be an understanding that death and grieving goes through stages. And
right.
Mothers, black girlfriends, white girlfriends, Asian, whatever. We all go through that same grieving period. And at this point, do you realize that between January 1st and March, we've had almost 200 mass killings in this country?
Wow.
We've lost some 200 to 300 young lives just in mass shooting. And some of it is where there's a party going on, and like in my home state of Virginia. There was a party going on, and somebody drove up in there and just started shooting because they didn't like the way he looked at him. You know, we kill each other over shoes, and he disrespected me. You 15 years old, you don't even know what respect is yet. You know what I mean? It's tough, but the question is, where are these guns coming from? Where are the, how can a 15-year-old kid like the one in, what was that, Philadelphia, I think, the other day. No, yeah. Tennessee. With a AK-47. Where did he get that? Or like the little white boy that Parrish drove him into Wisconsin, and he gets out there and starts shooting. Is this mama gave, we know where he got his from. His mama gave him that and then drove him down there. Now, who's to blame? If he had gotten murdered, who was to blame for that? That was his mother that would have gotten blamed on that. But on our side, where have we fallen apart? You were talking generational and the war that's been against black men. My great-grandfather, I had the opportunity to know, he died in 1965. He was born in 1864, born into slavery. And he told me the stories of being bucked. Do you ever heard that before? And this is where the slave master that were gay, the gay slave masters would have sex with these young boys. And then they would force them to walk around with their pants halfway hanging off their hindpots, okay? And the reason for that was so that the other gay slave masters knew who they were, okay? So when I see young boys today doing that, they say, well, you know, we saw it in prison. No, baby, this came way before prisons. This goes back to slavery, and that's what you symbolize. At Norfolk State, when I was there, I dressed up every day. Because, see, what a lot of these young kids need today is to see somebody that's, as my daughter would say, to be Barackable. Mm-hmm. You remember, Barack was smooth, man. You know, you never saw him get upset or nothing. They would holler and scream at him. But he was just this, and he treated his lady right. And our kids don't see a lot of that today. And they think
because black professionals move out of the neighborhood. Now, let me ask you this. Do you feel that gun violence among black males is a public health issue?
Yes. Yes.
How so?
We need to. First of all, you know, there was a judge in Fulton County. Remember Judge Arrington?
No, I haven't been here that long.
All right, well, Judge Arrington, one day I had just moved here. This must have been back in 04 or 05. And one day he got in court and got angry. He said, can all the white folks please step out of this courtroom for just a minute? Because I need to talk to my people. And they did, and the white folks really got mad. They were running around, how can he do that? But he closed that door. He said, I'm getting tired of this. I'm getting tired of looking at all these young, great minds sitting in front of me and are just going away. You know, I heard a sermon once, too, where they were talking about sometimes we get our careers on the wrong train. And what happens is you could have been a CEO of an organization, of a great company, but you chose to take the glamorous, because, see, you know, theater and everybody in my day in particular. See, I'm 68 years old. I came up under Jim Crow and when we had the black exploitation movies and all that. So we glamorized Superfly. You know, he was a drug dealer, you know, and we made it look cool.
Right.
But it
right.
really, it really wasn't. But that was another, you know, if you even go back further, when you look at Amos and Andy mm-hmm. and how they acted in Lightning, well, that was an intro to get us into the theaters. That's how they got to make money and then came back out and went to Michelle Michonne, who was owned the first black-owned theater up in New York. He was able to make movies that made us look good. You know, he could pull out the Lena Horne, the young pretty girl that was out there, and you didn't see her out there twerking with no clothes on, but she was just a beautiful thing. You had Lena Horne, you had Dionne Warwick, and from that, we just kept growing. We kept growing and kept growing. And now, look where we are now. We got
to wait. Hold up, Mr. Van. The entertainment business is another system that portrayed the black man in the neck of life and encourages
mm-hmm.
young black boys to get into these negative behaviors.
Yes.
They do. Check this out. In the 90s, when Denzel Washington got his first Grammy, an Oscar.
He
did a better job with Malcolm X, but he wasn't mentioned. He didn't get nominated for an Oscar. He got nominated for an Oscar as a crooked cop.
Right. Yeah. How about your girl, Tyler Barrett, her Oscar?
Yeah.
Movie.
Yeah, I don't know.
In this bad light, that, you know, we can't. That's why, you know, people like from my day, Sidney Poitier.
Right.
He do a movie. They asked him to do this one movie where he was a wife beater, and he had to wear a wife beater, be sitting in the front yard drunk, and the way the movie was progressing around him about that, and he said no. He said, no, I'm not selling my people out like that. This is the exact quote. I'm not selling my people out like that. Mm. He, if you ever watched Sidney Poitier's movies, in the majority of them, he was a black man working, trying to make ends meet for his family. He wore a shirt and tie in two or three of them. He was in the field in Lilies of the Fields and with the nuns and doing stuff, and they became happy and trusted. He never wanted to do that, and there were several of them during that period that wouldn't fall into that. You know, they didn't want that. But today, see, all money ain't good money. That's one thing we got to teach our young folks. First of all money ain't good money, and don't let people lose you who you are. One of my grandmother's prayers was always, "Let my children just have a little character," and that's one of the things we've lost today. With our young black men to keep them. You know, in my day, Negro History Week was a week. That's all it was. Black History Month was a 1 week. But our teachers did so much for us in that 1 week. And we learned, and they kept us going throughout. This is before integration. They didn't have the best books to teach young black men. But the teachers, Mr. Godfrey, Mr. Gardette, Mr. Golson, Mr. Waters, Mr. Edwards, they wore shirt and ties to work every day, okay? They
just look like
men when you saw them.
Look like they're going to the club. Let me ask you this, Mr. Flynn. Do you think that our youth are fearful of gun violence?
No. They think it's a game. You know, one time it was one of the victims' funerals I went to, and the mother asked me to speak. And I got for a quick brief thing, and one of the things I told them, I had them to all come and gather around the casket. And I said, I want you to find the reset button so your friend can get back up and get out that casket. Come walk around and touch it. Look for it. Find that button on there. And they looked puzzled. I said, there is none. when you play these video games and you shooting and killing, then the next day you get back up and you start all over again. This isn't starting over anymore. This is a final right there. This is the final scene of this 15-year-old baby's life. And you out here thinking you're tough and you're bad, but it's not. And you need to find a way. And I said, I take some of the blame for you. I do. I take personal. My wife and I have this out. My wife is Lynn Vaughn, used to be at CNN Headline News. She was anchor there. And we debate a lot about things going on. And she said, I'm not taking the blame for these kids. I said, I am. Because when my group came up, we started getting out there and we started integrating the corporations. And so we wanted to be promoted. Say, well, to get promoted, you got to be at the golf course on Sunday. And that's what we started doing. We took our families out there. Now, I didn't take mine. My daughters would tell you, they were in church every Sunday morning. And I think that had something to do with it, too. But the majority of us did that. Then we started moving. Now, we had a neighborhood. My mother was a single parent. But my daddy's brothers and his uncles, all of them made sure I had the right upbringing. My neighbors did. You were saying something earlier about us moving out of our neighborhoods. We don't have the same neighborhoods we had in those days. Those black neighborhoods were strong. Just within my block, we had two doctors, a dentist. We had the editor of the black newspaper. We had some nurses. We had teachers. We had janitors. Okay,
and they moved out during the crack era, and they all moved out. I'm going to turn it over to press one if you have a comment or a question for our guest, Mr. Vaughn. This is Rashawn Williams, my co-host. Rashawn, do you have a question for Mr. Vaughn?
Hello, Mr. Vaughn. Yes, I do.
How are you doing?
Black on black crime, a symptom of systemic racism.
Yes. I'm gonna say yes on that. I'm going way out there. And I don't like black on black crime, but that's what it is. You know, call it as it is. And this racism has caused these kids to want to still be important. They want to still feel like they've been lifted. Well, the schools have stopped. They have, you know, we went through 4 years of a Department of Education where the secretary couldn't spell, okay? The secretary couldn't spell. So you got a whole system that these kids grew up in. Systematically, racism is going to be here for a long time. My mother used to say that until I die, she die, and maybe my daughters before racism will be gone completely. But as long as there's somebody that feels they need to be over somebody, you're going to have them. Our young black boys, though, they don't have within their neighborhoods the people that can lift them up. They don't see people doing. They're still in places where they are going to be the first generation to graduate from high school, still being the first generation that they're going to college. So they've been pushed down for so long that they're actually blowing up. The problem is they're blowing up against each other. I heard today, you know, that we're in a war. We're in a civil war. We are fighting a battle, but we don't need to fight that battle by ourselves, within ourselves. We don't need, the battle is not against my brother. My battle is not against Kenny. I'm so proud of him and what he's doing with this show. I love it. And so we need to lift each other up and not kill each other and bury each other in the ground. That's something, and it's hard. You know, I try every day. You know, one of the things, we can talk about what's going on, but what do we need to do? What are you going to do? You know, I researched about young black boys being killed in America, and then finding out that in 3 months this year we had lost 250 people through mass shootings. I ran across one little, where is it? It's in, I think, Philadelphia. where they are now doing outreach again. They're going back to these outreach programs where they can find people that are trying to help the black community. The title of it was Diverting You from the Justice System is the Key to Racial Equality. You know, our kids are always having to, if they act up in school, they get sent home. Little Johnny acts up in school, he goes to counseling. You know, it's like the movie Billie Holiday versus the United States. She got on drugs. They try to put her in jail. Julia Garland doing the same period, using the same exact drugs. What she do? They send her to counseling. They send her to rehab. And this, you're right. This is the battle that this racism here has on us. And a lot of people don't even know that they being racist. You know, I was listening.
Do you think that black people can help themselves? I mean, because what it seems like is they're always needing, some of them, help from others. So
mm-hmm.
do you think they can help themselves?
Yeah, I think we can. First of all, we have to trust ourselves. We have to believe that we can do it. We have to believe that every time we fail, you know, I used to tell the kids in Norfolk State this, yeah, you failed the course this semester, but, you know, stay out the student union for a minute, get to your books. You can pull this back out. You can do this. It's within us, within our being to be successful. We can do this. We don't go to black businesses because we say, well, the price too high, because we always looking for the hookup. You know, we called an attorney for some help. Yo, man, can you do this great product for me? You know, I ain't got no coins right now. But if we go to somebody else, we're going to pay them everything we got to get it. So, yeah, we can help each other. We just got to believe that we can help each other. And there are going to be some, you know, everybody ain't painted with the same brush. So, yeah, there's still some that we're going to have to reach back and pull them on up here with us. You know, my cousin Tim Reed did a movie once called Once Upon a Time When We Were Colored. And colored people, I remember when we were called colored, that's when the water fountains were separate and the bathrooms, and we go down to Atlanta somewhere riding in the car. We couldn't even pull off on the side at a filling station to use the bathroom. You know, I lived through that. I know about that. But the colored people had their own. They had their own colored beaches. Did you hear the story where out in California and Brooklyn City Beach out there used to belong to a black family, but they took it. See, when we needed to take it back, and the family tried, but finally somebody
gonna give it up. They're not gonna give it up.
Yep, that's it right there. But we did. We had a black beach in Virginia called Seaview Beach. My best friend, the Watts family, owned it. And we go there and were just as proud, baby. We were just as proud. We could go to the Sahib Club and party. We were proud. That was ours. We went to the black store. My first white family had a little cafe on the corner. And we'd be in there happy. The boys be singing on the corner. But we had respect for each other. And at the same time, if you embarrass your family, which these young boys don't have, it's shame. We don't have shame.
I have a question for you.
Hmm?
Are racist propaganda campaigns that categorically claim black people are as a race of criminals, do you think that's a major part of the problem that black people face, mainly black males?
If they let themselves believe it, yeah, it is a problem. But you
it's a problem
if
somebody else believes it.
Hmm?
I mean, it's a major problem when others believe it.
Right.
Because they're more likely to draw that gun first and shoot first before they try to find out what's going on.
Right. Exactly. And, you know, I was listening. That's a good point, too. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was listening to the trial today. Minnesota versus Chauvin, the guy that killed George. And they had an instructor in there. And his thing was, you know, when you get there, we teach them to assess the situation. And if somebody is threatening, then you know you're going to have to use excessive force to take them down. And the prosecuting attorney, when cross-examining him, because this was a defense attorney, he said, now you said threatening. What do you mean when you say threatening? Well, you know, they make gestures. They've done something. Right then, I knew who he was talking about. So you got people that either knowingly or unknowingly are saying that black people are bad people. We're threatening. When a black man walks down the street, he's threatening. But we're not.
That's because, again, I blame the media for that. And mm-hmm. also, I blame us for believing our own stereotypes about mm-hmm. us. Let me ask you something. It is assessed that gun violence is related to economic factors in our neighborhoods. They say the poorer the neighborhood, the more violent it is. Do you agree with this finding?
No, not really. I think that the facts are true, right? Facts are facts. As to why it happens, when you look at a lot of them, you know, you get fed up with somebody, you get angry. And we, you know, this past year, it was even tougher than any year I've lived through. Because you were stuck in the house. Bills started piling up. You couldn't work anymore. Things were going on. So now you're frustrated. You're frustrated. Now, organized religion, which we have steered away from, but I still believe that there's a God. I believe that God will help us through anything. And the God
we
got to
help ourselves first.
Yeah. That's what he wants us to do. You know, somebody say, well, you got to wait on the Lord. And I say, yeah, but have you ever been to a restaurant and people are waiting on you? That means you got to work. Okay? Mm-hmm. You in the restaurant, the waiter is there. He's waiting on you and taking care of you. So when they say you got to wait on the Lord, well, I got to do the right thing to my brother. I got to make sure my sister over here has got what she needs. I might not have enough, but I'm going to know where to get some from to make sure. That's waiting on the Lord, see? That's what that is, in my opinion. Now, back to the question. We sing these songs that say, I got my Glock in my pocket, you know, and I'm riding around looking for something to do. We talk about, their music relies on three things, sex, violence, and money. That's all their music is all about. And people like Sony Records and all these big record companies, they making money off that. All right, they're making money. They're making big bucks because they long as they can keep us right there. But see, that's that music. Now you remember our music was Marvin Gaye. What's going on? You know, you had the Temptations. Papa was a Rolling Stone. We had all kinds of music, but we never really talked about killing each other like these kids do. So you're right.
But see, the record companies,
the
record companies is part of entertainment. Entertainment is part of media. Again, that's what I've been saying during this discussion, that media is part of the problem. And there's plenty of these groups that want to sing positive songs or rap about positive messages, but the recording companies push them to sing and rap about negative issues.
Right.
Like sex, money.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. Yeah, I've been preaching that for a while now. Back when Jay-Z, we paid him $5,000 at Norfolk State for a homecoming. That's how long I've been preaching that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
I have a question. What you all just said, is there something genetically wrong with black males then?
No.
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 That's
what they want us to believe.
That's the white man's fear. See, I understand
a white man's fear, but when it comes to black-on-black crime, though, we're going to leave the white man out of it for a second.
All right, let's put them to the side. And you're right.
Okay,
this was supposed to be the original discussion.
Why are black males killing each other?
It's not genetically. I think that
there's something wrong.
I think it's socially. It's the music. It's not genetics. It's where their mind thought is. I can't let you disrespect me. So if you look at me funny, then I got to shoot you. I got to beat you up. And the girls are just as bad. I've seen these videos out here with these girls scrapping like men. I'm like, what is going on?
Mr. Vaughn. One of our callers have a question or a comment for you. Hold on for a second. 4932, welcome to Black Urban America. You're on the air.
Hey, how's everybody doing?
How you doing? Welcome to Black Urban America.
Great. I got a question, a couple of questions for the guest.
Go right ahead.
Number one. What do you think is the number one problem for Black America?
The number one problem?
Yes.
It's racism. In my years.
So what do you think? So what's the number one thing you think Black people should do?
Believe in themselves.
To combat that.
Yeah, but you got to re-pull yourself up too, you know. How did we do it? How did colored people back in the 50s and 60s, when we couldn't even go in a restaurant or go get decent materials for school, how did we do it? We kept going. We never believed that we didn't have the opportunity to do it. They tried to take
it. Why did you have that opportunity then?
Because we had instructors and parents and a neighborhood and churches and this triad that was holding us up. And
I think what you're looking for probably is the fact that integration has damaged us as far as economically.
I wanted to jump on that. I was about to say,
I think that's the number one.
I think I comment on that and everything.
I believe that
you speak up, you spoke of, Mr. Farr, how we had teachers, preachers, business owners in the neighborhood, and we had our own neighborhood.
That's right. We didn't worry about trying to go over to Chinatown to get no Chinese. We didn't worry about going to the white banks because we had our own. Our problem is that the civil rights era has damaged us.
Right.
We became dependents rather than independents.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to get back to that. That's number one. Number two, we have to build up our own code.
Mm-hmm.
There is no other group that doesn't go without a code. We're the only ones that don't come with a code.
Mm-hmm.
We have to have that. Without a code, we're going to be sorry, and none of us. You see what's going on in Minnesota, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everybody's talking about, you should vote. People that went and rioted and stuff, you got more stuff done that way than voting.
Voting ain't gave us nothing. I think voting did. We have to walk and chew gum. You know, we have to deal with our own internal things that we've got going on.
I'm not saying that, but my point.
I agree with the fact that integration didn't help us a great deal. It gave us...
At all.
Yeah. It didn't help
like
us.
Like you said, our kids not seeing our own people up in there being teachers, that right there is immediate. That should be just trampled on as far
mm-hmm.
as us sitting up there calling ourselves being able... That's the beginning of white supremacy. You gotta debrief your children every day that they come home from school because they didn't gave them their little white Santa Claus, and they didn't gave them their little white Valentine's. They didn't gave them their little white teacher. They didn't gave them their white principal. We are suffering because of integration.
Well, now, it exposed us to some more economics through integration, too. We got to have that, and we've got to live. You know, who was that, Marcus Garvey, that wanted us to have our own country?
Yes,
and that's right.
He wanted us to have our own economics, our own social system, you know. And
that's right.
We had got away from knowing who we are and being who we are. Matter of fact, I said this last week, or a couple weeks ago, we had became more white than white folks.
Despite what people believe, Martin Luther King wasn't going for this, what we got.
Mm-mm.
He was pushing for us to have economic growth along with reparations.
That was his next move.
Yes.
Of us with economic
but we got out of, we have gotten out of a line from that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have.
It's killing us.
You know, I've been able to look at this because, like I said, I came up through all of it. And after we got integrated, at my school, I.C. Norcom High School, which is one of the few high schools in the country, originally black high schools in the country that's still in existence. Because what did they do?
It's still in existence.
They took all the good teachers that Norcom had, all the strong good teachers that was developing along the way, Mr. Fears and Mr. Edwards and the choir director. They took them all away and dispersed them in the white high schools. Then they went through Virginia and closed all the black high schools except for I.C. Norcom, Booker T. Washington, are the only two original, and they've been there since the 1800s. And my daughters, when they graduated from there, they were the fourth generations of Vans to come out. But how did we keep that school? We went downtown, baby, and scared them white folks. We broke into the school board and said, not today. You're not going to take this school. The black folks in Norfolk that had Booker T. Washington did the same exact thing. So those two schools, we fought for those schools to stay where they are and be like they are. They still not fully.
Did they feed them economically?
Yes. Matter of fact, they had to. Norcom's band was traveling all over the country. We used to have to sell donuts just to get to where we had to go. We had to get donations from people. Woodrow Wilson didn't have nothing. Couldn't play nothing, couldn't go nowhere, but they would send them all over the country. The school board would pay for it, but we didn't have anything to pay for that would pay it for us. So, yeah, after they realized what was going on and the city was starting to stop going downtown, they protested against it. And they were shutting down the stores downtown, Portsmouth, and before you know it, they said, okay, well, we're going to keep this school. They built us. Norcom is one of the few schools that my daughters graduated from the new building and that they named I.C. Norcom. They just continued the school because it's part of the school, and we fought for it. We fought for that school, and it's good. And a lot of great kids have come out of there over the generations. I mean, they just – we got generals in there. We got doctors. We got lawyers. And they're independent by themselves, got their own offices. So you're right. Integration hurt. But we in Portsmouth have segregation.
Okay. 4922, I thank you for your question. I have another call. Okay. 5240. Welcome to Black Urban America. You're on the line. 5240.
Oh, yes. I just want to say that this is a good topic and something, you know, me and another employee was talking about earlier, about blacks and the way we're going with Black Lives Matter. So this is one of the problems we talked about earlier. I don't have much to say, but I just agree with a lot of what people are saying, that our blacks, you know, we acting up, we going about shit the wrong way, and it's about education, economics. I think that if Martin Luther King was alive today, he would like, nah, this is not the route that I wanted us to go. I think we're going totally left from what we were supposed to be going. That's just my two cents on it, man, and it's a good show. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Let's get back on topic. Do you think that our young brothers, well, hold on, most of our young brothers come from single family homes. Do you think being a part of these single parent homes play a is contribute to the gun violence by youth?
I don't think it contributes to the gun violence, but it keeps them in that situation. And let me help you. Let me back this up. You came from a single family home. I did too.
I did come from a single family.
All right. My grandmother's husband was a conductor on a train in Virginia, and he was killed. The train went overboard, and he was killed. He had left three young daughters. My grandmother ended up having her own beauty shop, opened it up to the house, and they didn't want her to do it in the city, but she said, okay, you'll take care of my children. In the old days, when you got pregnant, my mother was 17 years old when she got pregnant with me. And I was talking about shame. Not to bring shame to the family, my father had to marry her. His daddy told him, okay, now that you got to marry this girl, and after the day after y'all get married, you're going in the Navy. Okay? Now, you gotta remember, during that period, we still had the draft, too. And that's another
thing.
And we didn't have a lot of gangs because you got drafted and you had your own gang. You had a green uniform. You were given rifles. You could do all the killing you wanted to do, okay? But when you came out a better man. A lot of them were from single parents. My mother made sure I had everything I had. But what happened in my neighborhood was that Mr. Key and Mr. Ealy and Mr. DeBerry and Uncle James, they made sure that if their grass got cut, I had to cut the grass too. Well, no man in my house, but I was out there cutting the grass and digging because 10 years old, I carried the papers, carried the gentleman guide. I worked during high school. I was working at the veterinary hospital because every man in my neighborhood showed me that this is what real men do. They take care of the home.
Hold on,
but no, I was
in the city. Hold on, Mr. Fong. Hold on. Before I'm going back to positive images in the neighborhoods.
Right.
I'm trying to convey this message for years. A lot of positive images have moved out of our neighborhoods, are living in what they call multicultural neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
These are no longer there. If they're there, it is very, very few. In my estimate.
And I agree. I'm guilty of it, and I agree with it as well. You're right, and that's what I had. My dad's brothers were there. You know, all four of his brothers would come and pick me up on the weekends when they got, especially those that were in the military, they would come home and take me out. It was the image that I had. So, and I wasn't the only one. There was a lot of young black men that grew up with me that had these father images, that had, didn't necessarily have a father, but they had a granddaddy around them, an uncle, even just a neighbor. We've gotten away from that. We have gotten far away from that now, you know.
And I feel that's a solution.
Yeah.
That's a solution to young black males get involved. Because see, what do they see in these neighborhoods, the poorer neighborhoods or the low-income neighborhoods? Gangs, drug dealers, you know? It's almost like they don't have too many options. But
positive
black men really have to put back in these neighborhoods that they come from, grew up in. Well, now a lot of young black men, positive young black men, are growing up in what I call multicultural neighborhoods. And I'm not putting a damper on our black community. It just is not enough to tackle these issues that are in low-income black neighborhoods. I like
exactly.
A Boston law. Michonne, I'm sorry. Let Michonne get, I know she got another question up in here. Michonne?
Okay. I want to know who is responsible for creating the breeding ground for the crimes in the black community?
Say that again.
Who is responsible for creating a breeding ground for criminals or crime?
A breeding ground for criminals.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's a topic. Now, we were talking just a second ago. We were just talking, and one is we don't have, like Ken was just saying, there's not a neighborhood image to show them that there's a different way to go. You know, if I, you know, when I, at the DA's office, a lot of kids, I was just the defendants, even though I was working for the prosecution, I would sit with the defendants and say, what made you do that? What made you think you could break in these people's house and get away with it? What made, well, you know, that's how my boy Ned did it. He was around there for a long time, and he knew how to get in them people's house. So I figured that, well, did you maybe think you could go to the local store and ask him, could you sweep the floor, and then he might give you some money if you needed money to do that? Do you think it was something else? Well, I ain't had nobody to show me. Oh. So this creates that breeding ground, you see, because it's like Kim was saying, they don't have an image. They don't have any other thing to see different from them. The music say I got to ride with the Glock. I'm riding dirty. The television shows they watch, Love and Hip Hop, they fighting and carrying on, and they got all this bling and bing, and they cussing and fussing and fighting. Even though they got plenty of money,
guys, we have another caller here. Let's bring this caller on. They might have a question or a comment. 6120, you on Welcome to Black Urban America.
Yeah, hi. I was calling because I had a comment. And
go ahead.
I think this is a good subject, and you guess he's talking good stuff. But what I would say is that in terms of how we grew up back in the day and now, the horses are stable. I mean, we'll never get in low-income areas. We'll never get neighborhoods like that. So I think the only way to turn around in low-income neighborhoods is you got to get control of these schools. The schools have to be nerve centers. The schools have to be parents. The schools have to be positive role models. The kids have to go there to learn their work ethics. They have to go there for mental health issues. I mean, they have to be more than just places where the kids are educated academically. And the only way for us to get control of these schools is to leverage our vote to force politicians to turn the curriculum control and everything else over to us. We have to use these schools as nerve centers because these kids are exposed to too many other things and there are too many competing interests for our kids' attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's not social media. It's different advertisers. It's negative influences in the neighborhood. There's just too many of them. When we grew up, these kids didn't have so many distractions. Everybody was much more conservative. So the horse is out of the stable. You're not going to get it back in low-income neighborhoods. Now, in more affluent neighborhoods, they already have that. But in low-income neighborhoods, the only way to turn it around is you have control of these schools. Either you have to start your own school, your private schools, or you have to force the vote and tell them we want to control it, that you continue to fund the schools, but we'll take over the curriculum and we're in charge of how our kids are taught and what our kids are taught. That's the only way you can turn it around in low-income. That's the only way you can stop the black and black
curriculum. We have to make sure that the curriculum is culturally based, Afrocentric, and also includes STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Right.
You're right. We have, and they're doing that. And we, in certain neighborhoods, like in Brooklyn in certain neighborhoods like in Cleveland, they are starting with this Afrocentric curriculum. We got to make sure that our children see, again, I'll go to positive images, that our children see us in these curriculum, such as history, mathematics, science, and what have you. We got to make sure that they know that we are the originators of all these different subjects that are being taught around the world.
Let me jump in here on that one, because I got it written down right here. Charter schools are deadly. I'm just as against charter schools as I can be, and people don't need, my wife won't
so
embrace
am I.
It. Because
it's a con job.
What charter schools do, they're able to make up their own curriculum. They're able to say that charter schools are the best schools because economically they have the best budgets, well, and they have the best teachers. Here's the trick to it, though. The building that the charter schools are in is not included in that school's budget. The schools in Pittsburgh and Mechanicsville and the neighborhood, the black neighborhoods around South Atlanta, the poor principal got to pay to make sure he's got enough money to pay the teachers, got enough money for the supplies, got enough money to take care of the building. Two of the largest expenses of any business, anything you do, are your personnel, your payroll, and the maintenance of the building that you're in. If
right.
you don't have responsibility, but the public school system is still taking care of that building. But that school's budget, which is the same as any other public schools, they got the same exact budget, but he ain't got no building maintenance in there. So he can go up to in the school and say, I want the best teachers you got at this college, and here's what I'm going to offer them. I can double what everybody does. The schools, the regular public schools can't do that. They don't have that opportunity to. They took that away from us. So that when these charter schools take from the public schools and the regular little elementary public schools, the teachers, poor teachers, got to come out their pockets, buy supplies. They just as broke when they get paid because, and you're right, we've got to get good teachers. We got to tell these universities, too. We got to tell these HBCUs, too. We got to tell regular colleges out here, you got to produce some good teachers, okay? Because we want teachers that have the compassion to be a teacher. The teachers today, most of them are good. The majority are good. But there's a lot of them say, well, I'm going to teach until I can get my record dropped. What kind of sense that make? Our teachers were teachers because they wanted to make a difference in their community. They knew how they had been treated when they were going to schools, so they wanted to make sure that we got in.
A lot of teachers today are afraid of our young black males. They are. You want to know why? They're not in the communities no more. They come from all over the place. Well, we only have a minute left. I have to cut it off. That's it.
What?
I'll go fast on this bad boy. I would just like to thank Mr. Fong for coming on the show. I like to thank the listeners for the great comments and the great questions and everything. And we show them what you're talking about tomorrow night.
We're going to be talking about some current events.
Okay, great. Okay, yeah.
Rashawn, I've listened to a couple of your past shows. You're pretty good, too.
Yeah, I got you from me. So I'd like to thank everyone, and everyone have a great week, and I'll see you next Tuesday. And as always, I am because we are. We are because I am. Good night.
Good night.
Hold it, night.
Oh.